When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace recently launched the latest version of their platform, Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates, and an incredible feature called Cover Pages. Try the new Squarespace with a free trial at squarespace.com and enter offer code RIOT at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere.
This is the Book Riot Podcast, a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. This is episode 122. We're recording on Thursday, September 3rd. I'm Rebecca Shinsky. I'm here with Jeff O'Neill. We're coming to you from BookRiot.com.
We're here. We were just saying how this is the Sunday afternoon of the summer, this late Labor Day. It gives us an extra week of summer or takes a week away from fall. I'm not exactly sure how it works. But we're all dragging. I'm dragging. I got a cold.
Man, I'm dragging so hard.
Yeah, and the publishing industry wants us to believe it's fall because it was a huge week for new books, which we'll get to in a minute.
Enormous for new books. But man, yeah, this week has just felt like every day should be Friday. It's only Thursday. It has felt like it should be Friday for 4 days already. I'm just angry that it's not Friday yet. I'm just mad. It's probably good that I'm just going to like sit alone in my office today and be angry at the internet that it's not Friday. But we're going to survive. Big book season is upon us.
Yeah, so it kind of feels like we're stuck between gears, you know? Did you ever learn how to drive stick? Do you know how to drive a stick?
I didn't, but, like, I understand, how
like,
it works.
It's kind of like you're driving stick and you get stuck between gears or it's revving too much, but you're still stuck or neutral. That's how this week feels to me. Like, we should be in it's also hot. It's been hot and sticky here in New York. I'm just ready for summer to be over.
That's what has happened here, too. We had, like, one cool week, and it was such a little tasty tease of fall, and now it's hot again. And so I'm also angry about that it's hot and the fall books are out, but it doesn't feel like fall, and it's not yet Friday.
Yeah.
Everything is the worst.
Yeah, well, it's an odd time of year anyway, but especially since, again, this is as late as Labor Day can get. It's like, I don't know, it's like a little lacuna in the year that people are trying to understand how to fill. Anyway, let's get on to our first sponsor, Squarespace is back. If you've got time, if you've got, you know, something, you don't have anything to do this weekend, maybe you're dragging, maybe it's a good time to like start a new project, maybe something you've been thinking about. Sometimes the beginning part you can get energy up for. So, and one thing you might try if you're building a Squarespace for you or for somebody else, someone you know is thinking about doing something, squarespace.com is the easiest way to create beautiful websites, blogs, or online stores for you and your ideas. Elegant interface, beautiful templates, incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code RIOT at checkout to get 10% off. A lot of times in fall, you know, now that I have kids and they're getting to be the point where they're at school, daycare, activities, one thing that happens a lot around schools, daycare, activities, you need like, you know, you used to have newsletters for the soccer team or for church camp or, you know, for the preschool or the PTA. That's been replaced by the web and email and, you know, using online tools. And this is one of those deals where you may not need Squarespace for yourself right now, but I guarantee you there's someone in your life that's thinking about doing a website that could use Squarespace. So you might keep your ears open for that. Like you're trying to put up a schedule for the baseball, I guess it would be football practice or a basketball league or maybe a book club or something like that. You want your own private space. This is the way to do it. It's very easy, drag and drop interface. So you can move elements around, anything from sort of a one pager with a picture and some contact information or a schedule to fully featured professional sort of enterprise class websites are possible on Squarespace. So it can scale with you as you go from your humble little whatever to your giant whatever. Squarespace is the best way to do it. $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for years. So sign up for all 12 months. They'll throw in your domain registration. So Jimmy's tballchoir.org can be yours right there. Responsive design. This is something that back in the day we had to worry about, but you don't anymore because Squarespace's templates already have it covered. You need to look at the T-ball schedule on your phone. Looks great. Want to look at your giant desktop? also looks great. Every device in between. Also, every website comes with a free online store. So if you want to sell candy bars for Jimmy singing T-ball menagerie,
this gets better and better.
You can sell them right there. You can sell all the chocolate flavored wingdings you need. Cover Pages is a feature that allows you to set up a beautiful one page online presence in minutes. So like, I think this is something I've been thinking about myself. Like, I need just a website for myself, right? It's just, here's me, here's what I do, here's my contact information, and, you know, just a couple of quick things about me, you know, that I can put on a business card or could put in my email signature so people can find me. So that's something I'm thinking about doing as well. No credit card required, which is very cool. You get a two-week free trial. Don't have to enter your credit card, so you don't have to remember to cancel if it's not for you. Enter offer code RIOT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase. One example of a website. So as this airs, I will have recorded a live Reading Lives at the Strand with Tanwin and Dini Islam at the Strand. It'll be available in the Reading Lives podcast feed early next week. You can check it out. So just search for Reading Lives in iTunes. But her author page is built with Squarespace. And it looks really great. It's really beautiful. A couple nice big images, a left scroll bar that has, you know, links to reviews of her books, her own stories, bio, upcoming events, her business that she runs right there. It looks really good. It scales all the way up. I found it on first on my phone, and then I went over and tried it on my computer. Also look great. So that's one. It's a Tanwi Nandidi, Nandini. So it's a TANWINANDINI.com. I'll put a link in the show notes if that's easier there for you. So that's an example of a professional author's, you know, how they're using Squarespace to make something simple and beautiful. Again, it doesn't have to be much. You don't have to do much, but you want static information that you can change from time to time, or it can be a blog that you update a lot. Really good solution for all of your interneting needs. Okay.
Okay.
Follow up. Hallelujah and praise the whatever.
This makes me full on Southern lady praise the Lord and pass the ammunition.
This
happy.
Is probably so the best non news we could have hoped for.
It is. It's like confirmation that there will be no news, yes. I think, which is great. Back when Go Set a Watchman was coming out, Tanya Carter, who is Harper Lee's attorney and allegedly good friend, trusted confidant.
Oh, you threw an allegedly in there. Wow. Wow.
Okay. Hey, my skepticism is strong okay. about I this understand. Whole, sure, these there's shenanigans. But Tanya Carter had hinted that there might be another book in Harper Lee's safe deposit box. Like maybe this was going to be a trilogy. And I think we had all collectively flailed about what that would be like, especially now that we've seen this, what the early draft of To Kill a Mockingbird was. There was a lot of like, oh, if there is another book in this safe deposit box, what kind of shape is it going to be in? And what would happen? She agreed to hire a third party, you know, uninterested expert to examine
disinterested.
I can never remember if it's uninterested or disinterested.
Right.
But I do know when something is ironic or not. So. So she hired a disinterested expert to examine and authenticate, this is the best quote, the mysterious pages of text. And his name is James S. Jaffe. He's a rare books expert. He was brought into Monroeville recently. He has combed through the contents of Harper Lee's safe deposit box, and he has concluded that, hallelujah, there is not another new novel hiding in there.
It's good. I've got so many questions about this. One is, how big can the safe deposit? I mean, are we talking about like the Cask of Amontillado, or what are we looking at?
Definitely bigger than the safe deposit box that my passport lives
yeah,
in.
Yeah, right. So there's that. Interesting. I wonder that an initial announcement or comment that Carter made was kind of floating some a trial balloon to see what people's reaction would be. Mm. You know, to see like. Oh, are people interested or people are just going to revolt?
And, yeah.
The reaction was bad from everyone's like, no, I don't want anymore.
Yeah. I'm in full on like tinfoil hat mode with this also, because the article that Tanya Carter published on July 12th referred to how some of the previous goings through of Lee's box contained, like, indicated that there were seven unpublished or unfinished short stories and the beginnings of a novel called The Long Goodbye, which was a true crime book project. James S. Jaffe, the new disinterested investigator, said that none of those appear to be in the safe deposit box. And so I guess the thing I want to know now is, like, well, it's possible that they were before and now they're not. So you haven't really, like, Ghost at a Watchman happened and it's died off really quickly. I was talking about this on Twitter.
That is true.
Earlier this week, you know, like, everybody was talking about it before it came out. My, you know, whatever, I'm on the record. I didn't think the book was very good. I don't think it should have been published in the fashion that it was published in, without all the explanations that are necessary to understand what it really is. Since it just sort of fell off, I wonder, I guess I'm not beyond believing that maybe these things were in the safe deposit box. And now that the public response to Ghost at a Watchman was not all candy and unicorns and ticker tape parades, maybe these materials are no longer there because someone has realized that you sent a canary into the coal mine and it wasn't a good idea.
Well, the problem with this, like anything else in which we have this circular authority problem of, like, Carter is Lee's, you know, estate manager. Mm-hmm. She has authority to do whatever, as far as we can tell, so that there's no way to corroborate anything except, you know, tomorrow there could be, you know, we found some crap under the bed.
Right.
You know, unless this Jaffe has looked at every single thing that Carter could reasonably call Harper Lee's property, I'm always like, this could be, you know, Geraldo, Al Capone's tomb, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Always, there's always the plausibility that we could come back. I mean, it's good, I think, that at least this part was taken care of. I do wonder, like you, if this is like had been a smash, like Girl on the Train sort of momentum building, and we're selling 5 million copies this year, and it's just a huge thing, then there's a lot of extra incentive to conjure a text out of whatever is there.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe the sales have been... They're strong. I mean, we know they sold 1.1 million copies in the first 4 days. So even if it hadn't sold another copy after that, it's still a huge selling book. And I've gone on the record here and online too, saying I'm glad the book was made available. I'm super unhappy with the way it was packaged, kind of like you said before.
Yep.
But I think I've gotten what I need, or what I would like to see out of the Harper Lee unpublished corpus. Like,
yeah,
this is enough.
Yeah, I don't need to see anymore. Right? We've had enough.
Because presumably also, anything that hasn't been published to this point is not as polished and finished as Ghost at a Watchman, and it already was just barely, for me, crossing the line of acceptable sort of to do at this moment in Harper Lee's life. Now, if there's an anthology someday that says, these are Harper Lee's unpublished, unfinished, untouched manuscripts and short stories, and here's the first part of whatever, and it's sort of like, you know, we get these things from time to time.
Sure, and some Harper Lee expert writes an introduction and, like, annotates the thing of, like, hey, in this short story, you can see a connection to the ideas that she explored in To Kill a Mockingbird or whatever. Like, I'm here for that, but the way that Ghost at a Watchman was packaged and presented and marketed was really not okay with me.
Yeah, if there's a collection of short stories that comes out next year that has the same font and cover and said, you know, companion to Ghost at a Watchman, I'm going to flip something over heavy.
A biscuit. We'll find some biscuits and flip them.
You know, like a dense, you know, buttery biscuit. I'm gonna flip it over several times.
Sounds kind of good.
in a row. So anyway, so for now, you know, there's sort of a moratorium, at least among the Carter camp, it looks like, that we're not going to get anything, at least for a while. Interesting that this is made public.
It is. But everything's been public. There's been all of these, like, there's this thing, there's not this thing. Here's what's coming. Here's what the book is. Here's what else the book is. Here's what the book isn't. It's been so, like, the public, what's been presented publicly has been so strange.
Why would she do this? I mean, here's what I don't understand. Is this a PR deal, or is Carter really wondering, like, hey, what is this? Like, I just don't feel like it's the
matter. I don't know. Like, yeah. I can't decide if I think that Tanya Carter is really savvy or completely unsavvy. Like,
by some things maybe savvy and maybe about some things not.
I don't think that it could be somewhere in the middle. Like, This is either a keep your nose clean PR move. Look, we did bring in a disinterested third party. Now that I know that word for sure, I'm just going to say it as many times as possible in this episode. Look, I brought them in. I don't have anything to hide. I brought in an expert to look at stuff, and I let an expert see everything, and he's confirmed, and it turns out that I was wrong about the material. Like, it's either that or she's, I don't know. Man.
Yeah, I mean, maybe she was getting some more heat from reporters, like, what were you talking about? Let's see it, mm-hmm. bring it out, blah, blah, blah. And this is sort of a shut the people up mode. Mm-hmm. It has a weird knock-on effect of maybe for those inclined to think that she's more on the up and up than others, that she's not just a money-grubbing sort of exploiter. Like, there is a line she will not cross, and that is mm-hmm. if someone else who's an expert comes and says, this is, you know, detritus and errata. This is not something that's, you know, can qualify as a book. I don't know.
It's also interesting that they're bringing in a third party to make that to make that decision, if that's what the case is. Because Carter has been saying all along, Harper Lee wanted to publish Gossetta Watchmen. She knew that it was coming out. She knew the shape that it was coming out in. She was happy to have it out in the world. There was that picture of her holding it and smiling. But if Harper Lee is in the shape where she can make that decision about Gossetta Watchmen, then how come it's not Harper Lee making the decision about what's,
take a look at this crap.
What's in her safe deposit box, and what's new and what's publishable and what's not?
That's a really good point. It's a real arrow in the side of the idea that Lee is able and or willing and or whatever
that she's
as a part of the process.
Right, that she's a consenting participant. Yeah. You know, who's fully aware of what's happening.
Yeah, I do think the best case scenario is she doesn't know what's going on. I don't, from my point of view, there's no situation where she's like nodding along, understanding exactly what's happening. It just doesn't seem.
No.
It doesn't seem like what's going on.
I think this also tells us we're not going to be done talking about Harper Lee anytime soon. Like, I don't think this is the last we're going to hear about what's going on with the Harper Lee estate.
No,
there
no,
will be
not.
Something else. Somebody commented after a recent podcast, like, gosh, can we just stop talking about Harper Lee already? And I was like, look, I'm tired of it too. But there's news, and this is a huge story in the world of books this year, and it's just not going to go anywhere anytime soon. So here we are.
But that might be our last bit, unless we get some sales data about Gossetta Watchmen.
Yeah,
the end of
well,
a year or something
we're
like
gonna
that.
Because Sarah McLean and I are still going to win the bet about Gray selling more.
We'll get down to
Ghost
PRH
Watchmen.
And your crowing probability here in a few minutes.
So let's move on.
We
need to take a minute to remember Oliver Sacks, who died this week at the age of 82. He was a neurologist and a psychologist, and he wrote many. He was a prolific writer as well.
Like, just 13 books.
Many, a really just amazing man who spent his life trying to help people who were having unusual neurological problems that no one else could diagnose and figure out what was happening with these people. And so Oliver Sacks was the specialist who cracked the code, like sort of an uncranky Dr. House of neurology. And he wrote really beautifully and empathetically about the experiences that his patients had. He was fascinated by the human mind, by what our brains could do that was great for us and what our brains could do that was painful and difficult and made life hard. Just really important, I think, sensitive work about things that are hard to understand. He took these really complex neurological and psychological problems and told stories about the humans who experienced them and explained them in ways that you don't have to have an MD and a PhD to grasp. My first experience reading him was The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Was that yours as well?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
And
my first experience of him was, I think, on Radiolab. Because he was a frequent guest there. And then I picked up Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat after that. Interesting.
Yeah, and that collection is about largely people who have different problems with perception and like face blindness or not being able to recognize what they're seeing and the ways that the things that we see are connected to how we use language. And that was a story about a man who would look at his wife and not recognize that that was a human woman he was seeing. He thought he was seeing a hat. And that's an oversimplification grossly of what the story is. But most of his books are collections of vignettes about different patients that he saw, different people that he helped who had similar kinds of problems and experiences. I read Musicophilia a couple years ago, which is really fascinating. I mean, all his books are fascinating, but this one was about what music does in our brains and different patients that he had seen who had experienced like really remarkable experiences with music. One patient had a traumatic brain injury that before the brain injury, the person had like no musical skill to speak of. And after the brain injury became like, I think it was piano, became like a piano savant, sort of overnight could hear music and understand how music worked and play it without any formal training. Studies about what happens in our brains when we listen to music and how people who hallucinate that they're hearing music, the same parts of their brains light up as if there is actual input coming in from outside. Really amazing stuff. Hallucinations was one of the more recent collections, all about people who have different kinds of hallucinations and how you talk about that, what it's like to go through the world seeing and hearing things that aren't really there and having people just treat you like you're crazy. He was, I just think the way that he approached these problems was so human and really remarkable for how humanizing the writing was. We talked recently about Siddhartha Mukherjee's book, The Emperor of All Maladies, about cancer treatment. And I felt like the way that he approached writing about cancer and cancer patients, and not just the science, but the people that experience this every day, must have drawn on and been inspired in some way by the way that Oliver Sacks wrote.
Probably, if you haven't heard of Oliver Sacks before, you probably best know his work from the movie Awakenings, which is based on his book Awakenings. It starred Robert De Niro and Robin Williams, about these patients who had these really severe paralysis that looked like advanced Parkinson's. He came to work there in the late 60s. They had been in there since 1918. So they'd been there for, you know, multiple decades in this torpor. He and some other doctors there experimented with L-DOPA, and they woke up for a little while and didn't. And fascinating, heartbreaking, terrifying, beautiful movie and story and book. You know, what's wild about Sacks is the empathy is clear. His curiosity is clear. He isn't afraid of the brain and the mind, which I think is something I could learn from, because some of this stuff I find terrifying, to be honest.
Yeah, there's a real palpable sense of wonder.
Yeah, like this idea that, you know, you wake up, you could get the flu and suddenly you're a statue for 50 years and then you wake up for 6 days and then you go back to it. Like, that seems to me like one of the circles in the Inferno to me. Like, that's, but Sacks doesn't, he's unblinking, but also hopeful, I guess, that, you know, this great understanding we have and appreciation for this bizarre lump of flesh between our ears is good, you know. And I think a lot of the writing does bring into question a lot of the sort of post-Enlightenment ideas we have about the unicity and the stability of the self. I think there's no question about that. Can be hard to hear, but also it's true, so tough that it's hard to hear,
right.
To some degree, but really amazing things. Some really good, it's good on audio, I've found. There's vignettes, so you can listen to it at a time. It's interesting. It's scientific without being clinical.
That's a really great way to describe him. He's really one. And he wrote so openly and compassionately about his patients, but also very openly and honestly about his own diagnosis. Yes. When he found out that he had terminal cancer, which is what he passed away from, he continued writing these really wonderful pieces about what it was like to be the patient and to be hearing devastating news about his health and about his life. But he processed that with as much hope and as much grace as any of us could hope to have in the face of getting that kind of diagnosis. I think just a really fine example of what science can be, what writing can do, the power of writing about science in a way that reaches, you know, quote unquote, lay people, and being open all the way around. Like, I think curiosity is just the right word that you used. He was a really incredible man, and he's left us a really incredible body of work to read. So Oliver Sacks, you will be missed greatly.
Yeah. His memoir, My Life, came out last year, as mm-hmm. fate would have it. And his last few columns for the Times are really moving stuff about
they really are
coming to the end of your life and knowing what's happening, and at least literarily looking at it with grace and courage and fortitude. Speaking of non-grace and non-forge,
yeah, let's move on because I'm starting to tear up.
Yeah. This is a thing. I don't know if this is copycat syndrome or what's going on here. You know, this I've read too much about social proof and influence recently to dismiss the idea. We talked recently, actually an afterthought a week or so ago, because the story had already happened, about the student at the University of North. No, what was the other student? It was Duke.
I feel like we skipped it because we were like,
no, we came back and talked to it at the end of some other story.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is just 6 miles down Tobacco Road in Chapel Hill, down from Durham at Duke, where a student is objecting to the books in a 9/11 literature class because he thinks they're sympathetic towards terrorism. But wait for it.
The kicker
is he hasn't read any of the books. Which,
he has not read the books. He's concerned, this is my favorite part, that the class isn't, quote, fair and balanced. I wonder where he got that phrase.
Boy, I don't know. And I looked at the reading list. I've read a few of these books, I have to
say. So have I.
He objects to The Shadow of New Towers by Art Spiegelman, which, hey, I was in New York on September 11th. So was Art Spiegelman. That one seems right on the money to me. It's not even about terror. I mean, it's not about terrorists, really. So he hasn't done the reading. It's an oversized graphic novel. It's this huge monolith. It looks like that thing from 2001: A Space Odyssey. It's moving. It's powerful. It's confusing. It's, I would say, discomforting in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. As is The Reluctant. Yeah, The Reluctant Fundamentalist by Mohsin Hamid is one of the selections, and it is about a person who becomes a terrorist. It's a very quiet novel about the experiences of this person who finds himself in a devastating situation. The student who is a freshman, which I just want to be like, buddy, you are young.
You don't even know what you don't know.
You don't know what you don't know. We say it over and over. The purpose of a liberal arts education is to expose you to all kinds of ideas and experiences. But he's claiming, quote, the readings mostly focus on justifying the actions of terrorists, painting them as fighting against an American regime or mistaken idealists or good people just trying to do what they deem right. None of the readings assigned in the freshman seminar present the September 11th attacks from the perspective of those who died or from American families who lost loved ones. Okay.
Yeah,
well,
I don't know what to say about that. I really don't know what to say about this.
We don't have stories from the perspective of those who died because we don't know what that
would be fiction.
We can only guess. It would be fiction. And that would be fiction that could and probably will be written. Post 9/11 literature is its own. Mm-hmm. It is its own thing now. I'm sure there are memoirs by families who lost loved ones. There is fiction that explores the experience of losing someone in 9/11. There's lots of fiction where characters are in New York on September 11th.
Extremely loud, incredibly close.
Right.
We're
far enough away from September 11th now that it's showing up in anytime you're going to set fiction in New York in the early 2000s, the writers allude to it at least, or there's a mention of that day and how it played into the character's experience. I've come across it a lot in novels that I've been reading recently. I would guess that part of the function of this course about the literature of 9/11 is to present more than one perspective.
Or more than two. Like, even his language is unknowingly naive. Like, there aren't two perspectives on 9/11.
There's not the victims and the bad guys.
There's so many ways of coming at it. I mean, the other critique I'd have is his particular one is like, we're not getting the side of the people who died and the American side. Well, you know what? If you're a freshman at Chapel Hill, you know the Americans. I mean, you don't need mm-hmm. that part of the story. You know that. You've seen World Trade Center or Flight. I can't remember the name of the movie that's about the people who took over the flight that mm-hmm. I can't remember the flight number. 973. Anyway, 73. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But we know that story. Like, this is to round out, to enrich, to complicate. Like, fundamental worldview about how history works.
And if we are
is problematic.
If we are to try to make sense of why does terrorism exist in the world? How does an event like September 11th occur? How did an event like the Holocaust occur? Part of the mental work there is to understand how a human being buys into ideas that lead them to strap on a vest and set off a bomb, or that lead them to hijack an airplane, or that lead them to round up people of a different religion and put them in camps to kill them. That's part of the work. If we are to understand these world events, it has to be from more than one perspective. And fiction that explores that experience is part of doing that. A memoir that explores that experience, like Spiegelman's In the Shadow of No Towers, is part of doing that. I mean, not to mention that the primary problem here is that this person is objecting to books that he has not read.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you could make an argument after you've taken the course and read some of these books that, you know, there's a perspective missing in your quote unquote holistic look.
Also, he's not enrolled in the course.
I don't get it. The specific freshman, I don't care about. Like, this kid, whatever. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But it is part of this larger idea of, like, I don't know, curating your exposure to ideas and perspectives and judging them before even having any, you know. It's like commenting on a post by reading the title. That's whatever
which,
that is.
Which is a thing that happens.
Oh, my God. It's probably more than the contrary. Of commenting after reading, well, that might be unfair. But it's like sort of this need to judge and react to the mere sort of like spine of the book. Right.
Before. That's exactly.
It's insidious and it's pointless because then it's like he said, because what if I have the counter? It's like, well, I didn't read the books either and I disagree with you. And then where are we?
Right. And what happened? Like, I think I want to really know, what is this kid afraid of? What are you afraid is going to happen to you if you read these books? What are you afraid is going to happen to students who read these books? That they will have a more nuanced approach to understanding.
They're going to be brainwashed into sort
humanity
of joining
beyond
ISIS or something. Like, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good point. Like, what's the downside here? I guess that it's unfair. It's an unfair portrayal.
I think if you have to consider terrorists as humans who make decisions, however flawed the decisions and however evil the actions, if you have to consider a terrorist or a murderer or anyone who does a bad thing, if you have to consider a rapist as a human and try to figure out what that human experience is and read a story that explores that rather than painting with the broad brush of anyone who does any of these things is just bad, period,
right,
then all of his life gets harder.
Yeah. Well, it's not unlike, in a way, you know, what Sacks does for the mind is you have to look at the sort of the fragile notion of this stable self of the will and the free of choice, and that, you know, you are good and other people are bad, and so it was and so it shall ever be. I think we got to look. The other part of it is the post 9/11 reaction. Like, one of the poetry collections include is poems from Guantanamo. Boy, you got to take a hard look at Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. If you're interested in 9/11 and its aftermath and its precursors and the Iraq War and what's gone on Afghanistan and Iranian deals, like, the whole thing is so mind-bogglingly knotted and complicated that to not even start to have the conversation after having some exposure to various viewpoints. That's the thing I think that gets, it's not this particular student that it's getting me worked up, and also a lot of people I saw writing about it and tweeting about it getting worked up. It's like, whatever this mindset is, we need to cut this off. This cannot be the new standard for critiquing a world. It just can't be.
It can't be. And, you know, there is a lot of conservative rhetoric about like the conspiracy of liberal education.
Right.
And that all college professors just want to turn all of their students into pinko commie.
Yeah, look how well it's worked. You know, Donald Trump is the leading Republican. Anyway,
it's, yeah, this The kid who wrote this article is dropping the phrase fair and balanced. I've watched Fox News. I know what they say about colleges and professors and education. And it's worth noting that one of the students who has attended this class, who does consider himself conservative, says that the article is nothing but gossip mm-hmm. about a great course that's taught by an amazing professor. This student who is conservative said, through most of the semester and even in my final paper, I actively disagreed with some of the professor's opinions. He in turn welcomed my arguments, and as such, this course was amazingly valuable because it challenged my opinions. A spokesman for the university named Jim Gregory defended the class, and he notes that it's not required. And also, let me remind you again, this student has not enrolled in it. He says, Jim Gregory says, the university isn't forcing a set of beliefs. We're asking them to prepare for and engage in every lesson, debate, and conversation and share what they think. That's what education is supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And
This is insidious too at public schools, because I've seen it happen, like whispers and rumors, when I was at the University of Kansas, of, you know, there was a sort of an anonymous petition from the state legislature to the university to get the names of all the courses that had any material about homosexuality in it, right? As mm-hmm. a sort of, I guess, as a saber rattling, or not even saber rattling, but like saying the word saber to the idea yes. that you could possibly lose funding, or there are things. So these things where federal money and government money is involved also mm-hmm. can be very problematic, because I'm sure North Carolina, historically a Republican state, I'm sure they have a Republican state house. It's very different than sort of Duke, which could stick to its guns a lot more because it's a private entity. I mean, they have people right. they're beholden to as well, but it's not the state legislature, which is a political entity. So, you know, that's the thing that's very hard
If you want your education to only echo back the beliefs that you already have and to reinforce those, you need to go to a private school yep. that is built around the beliefs that you have and that you would like to have reinforced. If you're going to a public university, if you're going to a liberal arts university, if you're going, like I went to a Jesuit university, where you will be required to engage with ideas that are different from the ones that you grew up with. Mm-hmm. No matter who you are, you're going to be required to engage with something else, because this is what education is intended to do, to put us to take us 4 years later and put us out into the world as people who have a broader understanding and a bigger ability to engage with ideas and to ask meaningful questions and to understand that the world is not a black and white place, but has many shades of nuance, and that being a nuanced thinker is a valuable thing. That's what you're getting into when you sign up for liberal arts education, and that's important, and it needs to be preserved. What you were talking about at Kansas happened, a variation of that happened when I was in graduate school there. There was a professor who for years had been teaching a really popular human sexuality yeah. course, and it was popular because it was so honest and real, and he talked about...
Was it Dennis Daly?
It was Dennis Daly, yeah.
He went to my church. Yeah, nice guy.
Yeah, it was a well-known course with mm-hmm. the undergraduates, because he was like, look, you're young adults. Sex is important. It's a part of the human experience. We're all going to have it at some point. Let's talk about it in a real way. And he talked about not just, you know, mainstream acceptable versions of sexuality. He talked about sexuality as people age. He talked about gay sex. He talked about trans issues. And that was unacceptable. It had been challenged. Like, I think he probably was used to just getting hate mail from being a sex ed teacher mm-hmm. in Kansas for his career. But while I was in grad school there, the funding was pulled for his course, because he showed videos in class of, I think the thing that like put it over the edge was, he showed a video in class of an older couple having sex and was talking about what sexuality was like as we age. And the students were fine with it. There was no complaint, but word got out and someone in the Kansas legislature claimed that he was distributing pornography on campus, and Kansas got upset and they pulled the funding for that course. So he went and taught it off campus, but the university lost a great instructor. And a course that had been popular, like, for decades.
Oh, yeah. When I was an undergrad, like, it was... Because I didn't take the course. It was sort of a rite of passage. Like, because, people like, would take it.
Yeah, like, the notion that elderly people have sex lives and gay people have sex lives and people who aren't just, you know, like, middle-aged suburban people in a man-woman marriage with four kids and two dogs.
Yeah.
Anyway, and education is important.
I mean, I think you can draw a line between this and... you know, parents wanting some girls pulled from a library mm-hmm. because they haven't read it either. I mean, I think it's all, you know, the kids who see that happening are the ones that are going to balk at even trying things that they don't immediately know they're going to agree with, that mm-hmm. they're going to like. This idea that it's somehow their job to police the things they haven't read and what people are learning about. You know, and some people are conflating the trigger warning discussion with this, and that's bogus. And if you think that's true, you can go home. I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, to the left.
Speaking of people that can go home, these are people going home on purpose.
And we're proud of these people.
Yeah, I don't... Did we talk about...
We didn't. We were so just like over it.
Yeah,
we did not talk about the story last week.
The follow-up is actually more interesting than the initial controversy. So Kate Gale, who is still the managing editor of Red Hen Press, wrote a piece on the Huffington Post that she a couple days later pulled down, criticizing critics of the AWP, American Association of Writers and Writing Programs, and using some loaded language.
Oh, man.
Basically saying don't judge the AWP because of reasons. And this is reacting to some criticism of AWP about their own diversity initiatives, their panels, their process for selecting panels, and basically the sort of the standard contemporary critique of many institutions about diversity. There was a lot of immediate pushback, including yours truly, and others at BookRiot, I have to say.
Oh, yeah.
And then it was pulled.
She said some things that are not okay.
Yeah, not okay in a lot of different ways. And also, she didn't even know what she didn't know. Another one of those situations.
It was very revealing. Yeah. Like she said some things that clearly she thought were okay mm-hmm. to say. And that in itself was very telling.
And word comes down this week, Tuesday, as it so happens, that some of the board members, advisory board of Red Hen Press, including Sherman Alexie, Carrot Huango, and Helena Maria Veramontes, which I've read one of her books, which was great a long time ago. I just remembered that as soon as I said the name, have resigned. Some other authors have decided to go other ways. I think I even tweeted at the day of, I was looking at their message to see, like, who are these people? That Sherman Alexie was on the advisory board. I was like, boy, I don't know, because there was stuff about Native Americans in there that mm-hmm. was cringeworthy. I was like, boy, I don't think she asked Alexie to take mm-hmm. a look at this first. And we mentioned it here just because it's interesting follow-up, but also that this is the kind of thing that's starting to have knock-on effects, right?
Yes.
Your people are saying things out loud and other people are listening. And apparently, and this is, I've heard this from, you know, reputable sources that I don't know this personally, but that Red Hen Press itself has been committed to diversity. They've had diverse authors of different kinds. You know, you look at the advisory board and just the names I read off among others, people from different ethnicities and races and religious backgrounds from all over the country and beyond are on that advisory board. So it's not, you know, it's so bizarre. I mean, that makes it some of the bizarre piece. And I think the thing that's enlightening to me in this situation is this isn't a conservative freshman writing for the newspaper at Chapel Hill.
Right.
This is someone who's managing a press that has at least nominal commitment to issues of diversity and inclusivity, and still this is what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And people are not going to put up with it anymore. And I think this is one of those situations where if authors have some choices, they're going to start choosing presses and agents and editors that they feel good about aligning themselves with. And I hope the press itself, if not Gail herself, I know nothing about her, can sort of use this as a learning opportunity and really redouble their efforts and take a look at themselves and see if it's going to be any better.
Right. This is another example that words have consequences.
A very strange reaction, and I have to say, beyond the content of wanting to defend the AWP from critics and sort of step in. I don't know. I thought it very bizarre. Very bizarre.
It's hard when a thing that you care about is criticized.
I guess so, yeah.
And it looked to me like Kate Gale's piece was kind of knee-jerk. Like, if you're criticizing this thing that I care about, then you must be criticizing me too. Like, if AWP isn't good, then maybe I'm not good because I'm part of AWP. And rather than looking for solutions and looking at, okay, what maybe there are some problems in how AWP does things, what could we do to make those better? It was a very ugly very sarcastic, yes, and snarky defense.
Exaggerating people's positions and using outdated language.
And it's the kind of thing, like, we've seen this. This is a much, you know, less severe example, but it's the kind of thing that we saw, like, with Gamergate, when people who love games can't stand that those games are criticized for problematic representations of women and people of color. And so it becomes about attacking your critic rather than engaging with the criticism.
Because the people who are criticizing AWP here, my understanding is a lot of them are members of AWP. Like, they're part of this is in much of it. And I could.
Right.
I
there's a I'm call right. from within the body of AWP membership to address AWP's handling of diversity and to improve what they do. And the members of AWP are diverse and they want to see that done well. And Kate Gale really did not handle seeing criticism of an organization that she cared about. She did not handle that with any kind of grace.
It is interesting, too, that this is not the kind of story we were hearing both the back and forth 2 years ago when we started doing this show. This is a, I don't know if it's an inflection point for conversation about diversity or not. It feels to me like a different moment when the advisory board, high-profile authors of a press, stepped down because of, you know, this sort of insensitivity or obtuseness or whatever adjective you want to use. Like, people stepping down, people choosing different presses, people making career professional choices based on an individual and the institution that individual is in charge of, their reactions. And I think this is the tip of the iceberg to some degree. Speaking of that, Lian Lo, children's book publisher mostly, is that right?
Yes.
Do I have that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Who themselves are manifestly and openly committed to issues of diversity for children's books and representation, but also authorship and editorship all across the board, have started a petition to ask the big five publishers to release their diversity statistics about their – is it mostly their employees or also their authors?
Yes.
I didn't know if I got all the way down into it.
It's primarily about their the racial and ethnic makeup of the publishing workforce. Lian Lo has collected data from a lot of smaller publishers. They've been collecting this data for a while, and the call has been out there, and many smaller publishers and independent presses have opted in to put their numbers in so that Lian Lo can get, because publishing is not doing this on its own. So Lian Lo is taking steps to try to get sort of a baseline starting picture of what does diversity look like in the publishing workforce, with the belief that, as we've said many times, that part of getting more diverse books out into the world is having more people of color working in publishing at all the steps along the chain.
Or even so, if that's not the goal, it's just fair, right?
It's
just,
part right.
I mean, that would be a nice knock-on effect, but even it has its own sort of imperative.
Right. This is a net good in itself for publishing to become more diverse. And one of the things that Lian Lo really needs in order to have a rich and accurate baseline measure is numbers from the big five publishers who have not at present opted in to share this data. So they've started a change.org petition, and the hashtag big five, the word five, sign on, that you can participate in and help share around if you want to encourage the big five publishers to release these numbers for Lian Lo's survey, so that we have a, you know, an independent look at what the state of diversity is in the publishing workforce.
Yeah, it's unlike Vita, in which they can sort of post hoc do it by looking at bylines and who gets reviewed, because it's about, you know, reviews and reviewers of work in the wild. You know, there's not public access, I don't believe, to the employee names and positions of, you know, who works for Random House and editorial. And I don't know if they're asking
for all... Not to mention
all
racial and ethnic information. That's not...
That's also, if you get someone's name and they're not a public figure, unlike an author, which probably can find a website or publicity or something about it, very difficult. So they're asking, they're going straight to the horse's mouth to try to get the information. I can understand why the big five publishers might be reticent, because the numbers aren't going to be good. We know they're not going to be good. We've heard anecdotally, like from some self-reporting, that like something like 89% of the people in one particular... I think anonymized survey, 89% of the people were white. I wonder if it's even higher than that, because, you know, probably people of color might be might have been more, I don't know, amenable to participating in a survey mm-hmm. about diversity. That's just a supposition on my part. It could also go the other way. But it's not going to be good. And everyone knows it's not going to be good. And everyone knows I think it's not good. Right, I think we'd all love to be pleasantly surprised, but I don't think we're
right.
going to be.
I think, you know, we all know that it's not going to be good. Like, that writing is on the wall already. The jig is up. There's not a reason for publishers to sit on the data anymore. Well, there's not a good reason.
There's like, not a good reason. Yeah, there are reasons. One is that, you know, sometimes the actual numbers are going to play worse than the feeling or the supposition.
Sure. You know? The feeling is already, I don't know. I think the feeling is already there.
I don't know. I think if we got full data, you would get, I mean, not national headlines, but you would get a piece on Vox and you'd mm-hmm. get a piece on the Huffington. I mean, you'd get
and it, it
a
it's,
lot
it's to
of
the
coverage.
Tune of diversity in publishing is even more bad than we
and
thought.
It's even worse. And then what are you going to do next year?
Well,
what are
I
your
think
numbers
you,
going to look? I mean, this is all, I think, the same reasons I think Lee and Lowe is smart to ask for this is the same reason that, you know, the big five publishers probably don't want to do it because it's going to put
right.
pressure it's, on them to reveal, but also
gotta,
to change. Like that's
right.
The thing.
Right now it's easy to say we are committed to and we care yeah. about diversity, but you don't have to put any money where your mouth is.
Just like
is.
I'm eating my vegetables, Rebecca. I am. I'm trying to do better. Well, I'm committed
by vegetables,
to,
you mean donuts.
I'm committed to it. It's something I work on every day. We're committed to it in the long term. So, you know.
Yeah, what I want is.
The very thing you want is the thing they don't want.
Right.
I mean,
I want publishers to take their lumps and say, here's the reality, and take whatever the headlines are that come with that so that we can all live with that being the reality and start to work for more. Because I think we've talked on the show before about like when you pay attention and measure a thing, that makes it easier to change the thing. And if you're not measuring something, it's really hard to cause change. Vita has been effective in doing this with the coverage of women and now the coverage of people of color in book reviews. So measuring something and putting the numbers out publicly does create a kind of accountability that's not there currently
no.
in any, you know, official organized sense. I really hope that publishers will do this and just realize we all know the numbers are going to be bad. We all know the headlines are going to be depressing. We all know it's going to be a story, but we all know that this is the case.
Well, I think some of us do know. I think a lot of people don't. Hmm. And again, I'm not trying to justify the published reactions. I just understand it. I can totally see their position. I think it's wrong. I think they've kind of made their own bed here,
you know,
to some degree.
I think we're approaching a point in this industry where ignoring the reality is not going to be tolerated for much longer. And this is a demand from people signing this petition are trying to create a mandate for publishers to be transparent about the state of the industry. I don't think it's going to last much longer where people are just okay with publishers deciding
well,
not
that's
to.
What I'm saying. I mean, like, it wouldn't take much, but let's see. I'm trying to think of, you know, Toni Morrison to switch houses.
Right.
Right? Because, you know, she looks at she's Knopf, is that right? Her imprint?
Yeah, she's Knopf.
And, which is a Random House imprint. And look, just to use one, because that's what came to mind, is say, you know what? This is not all right. I want to see changes. Or until you change, I'm going to be with that publisher over there that's slightly better. Or I'm going to figure out something, you know, like mm-hmm. whatever. Or like Alexei stepping down from the board. Like it wouldn't take much. He's with Little Brown if he saw the Hachette numbers and be like, you know what? We got to do something about this. That kind of pressure, I think
imagine
that author,
James Patterson or Dan Brown or someone who sells bajillions of books.
John Green, you know, someone mm-hmm. who has a lot of juice. You know, anyone like that could really put the screws to somebody and say, you know, I think also, to be honest, a publisher could do something about it and say, you know, we've got a 5-year plan. Here's the number we want to be at in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be perfect. We're not all the way there, but we're going to make improvements and it takes some time. Because I do think this is not one of those situations necessarily. It could be, maybe it's not. But my sense is that it's not that they have a huge stack of editorial intern positions and they're only they're selecting disproportionate number of white people. I think that also that stack is disproportionately
yes,
white.
Absolutely.
So they got to do a full stack sort of like effort on the diversity part. And that is not something, and I do sympathize with this, that you can turn on overnight.
Right. It's not a quick fix. Yeah. But I think if somebody did have a good plan to say, yes, this is real, here's the plan. I think pressure has to come from not just the authors of color and the people of color who work in publishing and the small presses that are committed to diversity. It has to come from white people who work in publishing and white authors who sell millions of books and who benefit from the systemic racism that's built into this industry and that's built into many industries. This is a problem of our creation. Yep. And if we want it to get better, then we have to be the ones who make the noise and force it. This is a problem that we've all contributed to, and that unless you are going to take action and have a plan, you will continue to contribute to perpetuating it. It would be awesome. I would love to see a major best-selling author.
If one of the big five has the moxie, to be the first out of the gate here would be the pulp. This would be the move, right? Like you want to say, you know what? Here are numbers. We're not proud of them.
Right. Here's what we're going to try to do.
We'd love some ideas as well. We have a 5-year plan to sort of get us moving in the right direction. And that's not going to be the end of the struggle. That's not going to be the end of the story. And that can be the end of the effort. But here's what we want to do. And, you know, we're committed to doing it now, and we're going to be accountable. I think people are going to hear that first person.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be scary to be that first person. Yep. It's also an incredible opportunity.
Yeah, it's kind of like they say, you know, like public relations, get out ahead of it. Get out ahead of the story. You don't want to be the fourth, right, with your shitty numbers.
Right.
I have to bleep that. you don't want to be the fourth, but you'd like to be the first. You want to either have the best numbers or be the first with the bad numbers,
right,
and a plan and some self-reflection plan. Because it's kind of a problem like global warming, which if you're working at a publishing house now, this both is and isn't your doing, right? Like with global warming and climate change, like we both, you know, any of us who are alive both did and didn't do this. But that doesn't mean it's not our responsibility and our moral imperative to do something about it now.
Right.
Like I was making the case on Twitter the other day. I would think even from their own business, that the business case for more diverse titles and that is never thought about really blows me away. Because if anyone who's seen the sort of forward-looking demographic trends of the U.S. alone, I don't even know about the rest of the world. That's one of my great blind spots, is everything beyond the lower contiguous 48. But you look at the demographics, like there's fewer and fewer white people. And it's not going to be but like 10 or 15 years between white people in the U.S. are outnumbered by people who aren't white. And these are your future readers, man. Like these are the people who are 3 years old now. In 30 years, they're going to be the white hot center of your book buying public. And I think, you know, beyond even the, you know, a moral, ethical, feel good area, which I think is dismissive of it, because some people think it's just that social justice warrior crap. There's a business case to be made. Like, you are going to get left in the dust by something else. And I don't know if it's music, and I don't know if it's video games or whatever it might be. But if you don't, you know, people can tell when they're not being represented. Like, we've seen statistics, like the person that reads more books per capita than any other demographic are black women between the ages of 35 and 49. The highest incidence of reading one book per month is black girls between the ages of 8 and 14. Like, there's a disjunction here that is beyond, let's just make it fair. It's like, these are real opportunity here. And I think it's obtuse of publishers not to see that.
Absolutely. I think if publishers don't want to be political and don't want to talk about race problems, they could at least get their heads around the business case.
Yeah. You know, surely you're rapaciously greedy enough to see even that would make sense. So there's a lot of different ways. I don't think this one's going away myself.
I don't think so either. Justina Ireland wrote a piece about this campaign with Lee and Lowe for Book Riot. We'll put the link in the show notes. It has the link to the change.org petition. It has the link to Lee and Lowe's diversity statistics gathering efforts. It has more information, and you can click your way around those and dive into all of the data that Lee and Lowe collects and aggregates from around the web as well about the state of diversity in publishing. If that's a thing that interests you and you've listened to this far in the show, so we hope that it does, that it's a thing you care about.
I think
about.
Scholastic is the biggest one to have signed on so far. I think I saw that they had agreed to they're not one of the big five, but the biggest one of the also.
All right,
on
we got to roll on.
Yeah,
you gotta tell me about our next sponsor. We have Harry's back this week.
So here's the deal. Shaving is the worst. It's, you know, a daily grind of annoyance and expense. You know the story. You go buy, I think my, you know, my old stuff that I got at the pharmacy, I think it was $10,000 a blade. Like, I could be off, you know, inflation or whatever.
You have to give them a toe.
Yeah, it's crazy expensive. And it's, you know, you can only use this one kind. It's got 15 blades. You got to put a freaking battery in the thing. And it looks like, you know, something that Marty McFly found in Back to the Future Part 2. Harry's is going back to basics. It's a great blade with a great price. They're not just as good and half the price. They're better. The first blades were made in Germany that they had for their company, and they liked the blade so much that they said, you know what? We'll take that factory. That's going to be ours now.
No big deal.
So why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? Just saying that makes me angry. It's half the price at Harry's.
For women.
Is it worse? I don't even know.
Yeah. The blades that I used to use were like $26 for four.
That's unacceptable. That's outrageous, and we can't have this.
We can't. This is why we have
Harry's. So you get a better shave that respects your skin, face, and legs, and your wallet. So that they're serving your back pocket and your face at the same time. How many companies can you say are doing that? The starter set to get you going, it's a very reasonable deal. So this is to see, you know, if Harry's is for you. $15 gets you a razor, moisturizing cream, and three razor blades, so you get the handle and blades and some junk to put on your face that'll help you not burn yourself or cut yourself. And use promo code BOOK, you can get $5 off that. So for $10, you can dip your toe in and get started with Harry's. Because, like, you know, I've said this before in a previous Harry's spot, like, there was at the time there where it was like the blades were so expensive, and I knew, you know, using them, you get a few uses out of them, you got to spend another $10,000 on that blade. I just let the beard go.
Also, you never have to leave the house because Harry's gets shipped to your door. And as a person who has legs to shave,
yes,
that's more surface area. So blades run out, you know, the blade goes bad faster than a blade does for a dude shaving a face that is less surface area. I don't want to go to CVS and make them unlock a thing for my razor blades that I have to hand over my right arm for. This comes to your door. It's automatic.
Yeah. Like, you sign up for a plan. They send, you know, you can pick the number of blades you need at one interval.
They show up at your house.
And like, I've thought about this before. I don't really know, like, how many faces is a pair of legs worth of shaving? Because, like, there's only so many, like, there's only so many hairs that
a
blade
can cut. This is like a very Silence of the Lambs feeling question.
What? it's you know, there's only so many hairs each blade can cut. So, like, if you're shaving legs, that's kind of at least five or six faces, maybe more, in there. So you're actually spending more per shaving cycle with if you're shaving your legs. And not just ladies shave legs, and not just legs are shaved in addition to faces, but we're gonna put a veil over that.
We're gonna stop there.
So when I start getting Harry's again, I'd shave more often, and, you know, I'm getting older, and I look younger when I shave. So it's not just a blade, it's a time machine. That's what we got here. So go to harrys.com and use promo code BOOK, and you get $5 off your Harry's starter kit. It's good for men and ladies. Maybe someone you know is going off to college. You know, you got a daughter or a son or a niece or a nephew or a grandkid. Maybe take care, you know, because that's even worse. You're paying $10,000 for a blade, and you just want beer money and book money, man. You don't want to spend on razor blades. So keep your new co-ed looking sharp and shaved. Sign them up for some Harry's, and you can have them sent automatically. And, you know, maybe they'll shave a little better. They'll respect themselves a little bit more, wear, you know, a little better clothes. They'll get a better job and take care of your donage. So it's a retirement plan.
This is like some real Don Draper stuff.
Yeah,
you're
it's
doing
a retirement
here.
Plan, really. I think of it.
It's not just a blade. It's a time machine.
You think of it as a 401k, your Harry's subscription to someone younger than you. Thank you so much to Harry's.
I've never felt so inspired about shaving my legs.
Well, that's what we're here for. We got to move some units. So thanks so much to Harry's, harrys.com. Offer code BOOK to get you rolling with some Harry's. All right.
Speaking of moving units. Moving units.
Juicy. This was good. This is good stuff.
This is so much good
PRH
stuff.
PRH released their first half results Monday. Mm-hmm. And PRH, I think we're thinking now, does more than half of the U.S. trade book market. I don't actually know. It might even be 60% at this point. Their revenues were up a whopping 16.2% in the first half of 2020, 2015. They did almost $2 billion themselves, $1.19 billion in revenues. Paula Hawkins' debut novel, The Girl on the Train, we know it's done well, but listen to this, 4.5 million copies across all formats. Gray, in its first 2 weeks of publication in the US and UK across all formats, 3.5 million units in 2 weeks.
That is not looking good
for the ghost at a watchman train. The conductor is getting nervous. The bridge is out, and the people are bailing off that particular wager.
I think you're alone on that train.
I'm the conductor, and I'm even sort of putting lace in my boots a little bit. Huge results. For PRH.
Up 16.2%, so the sky is not falling.
No. And while 4.5 million copies, so between Gray and Girl on the Train, that's 8 million books, which they get, what, 50% of the cover price on average? So $10. Mm-hmm. So that's only, I mean, those are big sellers, but those are only $80 million in revenue for this one point. I mean, it's a drop in the bucket is maybe... not putting it quite right, but 1.9 million, that's a lot of books.
So many.
That's a lot of books.
And ebooks and
Marcus
audiobooks.
Marcus Dole, the CEO of the publishing house, thanked employees, saying, "In my most optimistic moments, I could not have foreseen the publishing successes we have been enjoying this year."
That's great.
We all know the industry is unpredictable, blah, blah, blah. We can consistently rely, though, on our teams around the world. This is all feel-good stuff for if you're working there. So, I mean, I don't know, like... probably the two titles aren't enough to be sort of an outlier just because you got lucky with these couple, though it certainly doesn't hurt. And again, the E.L. James is only the last couple of days.
Those might be the big drivers, you know, they're leading the way. But Random House, Penguin Random House makes a lot of good books.
Yes, they
sell a lot of good books.
Yep. I mean, they also had, I'm just off the top of my head, they had a new Morris in this year, so mm-hmm. I'm sure that sold well.
Well, they published Aziz Ansari's memoir. Yes. He got like a $3 million advance for. I'm thinking they probably sold a bunch of those
books. So it'd be interesting.
Oh, they have a... Oh, never mind. It's the next half of the year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some stuff coming in the back half of the year, too, because mm-hmm. they've got the Franzen, right? Is that not...
No, FSG has the Franzen.
So that's...
But they have City on Fire, the Garth Rhys Kallberg debut novel that got a bajillion dollar mm-hmm. advance.
Well, you know what I'm seeing a lot of on the subway is The Martian.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. I think people have been seeing the trailer. They're dipping their toes in that. Michelle listened on the audiobook recently and loved it and has passed on to several other people. One day I was taking the train in and I saw three people reading paperbacks of The Martian. I'm like, huh. And that's Crown, which is PRH.
Yep. Riverhead is having a huge
Riverhead, which
year,
is Paula
and
Hawkins.
That's a Penguin imprint.
If Penguin Random House can be seen as a bellwether for the U.S. trade industry, business is a booming. 16.2% in a year for a mature business is
a
huge number there. So, publishers are going to start to release mid-year numbers. PRH was certainly leading with strength there, coming back in below. Okay, let's do it. Now, here's a weird story. What did you think of this story?
I don't know which one you're going
to... The Indianapolis's big free libraries campaign.
It's interesting.
Yeah, I have the same uptalk question mark as well. So this is the Indianapolis Library is doing a campaign called Big Free Libraries, clearly dovetailing onto the Little Free Library movement. Mm-hmm. And
it's art installations.
It's art installations
also.
Around the city.
Functioning library things that are also art installations.
Yeah, and the books, you just take them. It's called the Public Collection, a two-year program intended to support literacy and art appreciation in the Indianapolis community through making books freely available to the public at 8 art installations all around the downtown area.
It's cool.
It's cool. I guess, I don't know. There's something, again, I don't really begrudge dollars and effort spent on putting books into the world. I'm just trying to look at like, are they trying to compete with little free libraries? Are they trying to tap in?
I think they're. I don't think they're competing.
Okay.
I think this is like riding the coattails of the little free library movement, which puts books out into the public in maybe in unexpected locations. And there's a really powerful charm factor, yes, to the little free libraries. People just grassroots, love seeing those, yeah, around. Right. It's this thing that communities are doing for the other people who live in their communities. It's very cool. And I think, you know, we've established ourselves as fans of little free libraries here. Some of these installations are like awesome looking Dr. Seuss contraptions where you turn a crank and it moves the shelf around and then you can see the books and pick one out. Like, I think this is a good, books are cool, here's a cool thing the library has done. But I think my only reservation is, how much did this cost, if it cost the public library, and could those dollars have been used in a way that was more effective for the library's patrons?
Yeah, I've been wondering recently too, like the little free library movement has a little mojo behind it now. We see people talking about it, and we talk about it on the site, and when we write about a little free library, something gets a lot of attention and people are, mm-hmm, interested in it. And I do wonder, like, I mean, they're certainly not competing with a public library, but they're doing something similar but different that I can't really quite put my... You know what I'm talking about? I mean...
Yeah, I think it's that grassroots, yeah, thing.
Because it's like they are doing... They're doing some of the things a library do, but they're not certainly replacing not everything a library does. But the rules are different, right? Like, my understanding of a, mm-hmm, little Florida library is you can take a book and you don't have to bring it back. Like, it's no expectation necessarily that you bring the book back.
Yeah,
right?
It's kind of a give a book, take, yeah, a book situation, and you can do both or either. You can bring something and, you know, like, put in a book you just read and take something else out, but there is no expectation that you'll return it.
Right. So, you know, it does something different. Like, it's much more like browsing a used bookstore. You can't really be looking for anything particular, but you have to be open to sort of what everyone puts there. Who knows where the books are coming from a lot of times. I see them around my neighborhood, and I can tell that there are some other book reviewers in my neighborhood, because you can see there's ARCs and galleys and advanced reading copies of all kind, you know, finished pre-release books there. Interesting stuff. Swapna, who is our managing editor of panels, runs her own, and she kind of gives us updates about what's going on coming, and very interesting to see. You know, kind of, there's a connection too between the last story we did about Penguin Random House's numbers and libraries of all kinds and little free libraries. It really is amazing, and I can't think of another industry in which there's a big corporate industry that also has a part of the industry it's in that's largely free. Right? Mm-hmm. That you have libraries that are paid for with tax dollars, but there's no cost, at least to I know of, in most places, to the end user. Like, you don't have to pay extra, like $5 to get a library card. You have to use it. And if you, you know, return something late, you have to pay. But like, you have these publicly funded, beloved institutions that not only will people pay to have free books for other people to read in big buildings, but now we're at the point where I'm going to put a little one in my yard or at the end of my driveway. That, you know, we think of them as also non-commercial products at the same time. So it's very unusual, I think. If someone else can think of a different industry that's like this, I'd like to know. Maybe some people have, when I brought this up in private conversations, well, the public transportation, but that's not different. Mm. Like, you don't go rent a car. You know, you don't, right, go borrow a car. Like,
I think this is tied to this feeling and belief that readers have that books are a public
good, right? Exactly. Good. Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
And
yes.
That more books in the world is better for everyone. We, you know, we believe that reading opens our eyes and changes our world and gives us a broader understanding, and that books do all these good things, yeah, for us, and that we want that to be available to everyone. And I think the little free library is that we want to participate in that.
Yeah.
You know, like, I can donate books to my library, I donate books to Goodwill, but there's something about like putting things in a little free library that you're doing it, you can like watch it and see the people from your community, mm-hmm, come and leave books, then take them, something hands-on. It feels good to be doing the thing, and I think contributing to putting these things that you love, that you know are powerful, out into the world for other people to have access to. There's really something there. And you're right. Like, we haven't seen little free MP3 download
DVD
stations.
DVD stores, right, or, right, you know, little free CSAs, or, you know, it's just, there's no analog that I can think of. I guess clothing might be one, but you don't, I mean, you can go to the Salvation Army and something, get, mm-hmm, something for very inexpensive. But the sure, thing that's like, crazy is, like, you know, we're going to talk about new books in a minute. Like, I put on hold the Girl in the Spider's Web. New book. Mm. Like, a new book. It's, you know, I'm like third on the hold list. But that's not the same as, you know, getting something from Salvation Army or Goodwill or something like that. It was after the fact. It's much later. Like, you're competing directly with front list, full-priced hardback titles. It's it's really insane that the publishing industry exists at all. I mean, if the publishing industry went away, like libraries wouldn't have anything to put on the shelves, but it's that they compete. That's something that's hard to remember about book publishing as an industry, is that they compete to some degree. I mean, they are selling the books, but you can also get them for free. And the same romance about books and idealism about books that people have that makes us fund libraries, I also think makes us willing to pay for books for ourselves. So maybe it goes hand in hand, but very interesting to see. I wonder if there are things, though, that public libraries could do overtly to support little fray libraries. I wonder if there are, you know, public libraries, like, you know, could you distribute plans or best practices or provide maps of cities or, you know, where are the free libraries in our city here?
Maybe books that the public library reads could go into little free libraries.
Yeah, they have like a shelf where, you know, if you run a little free library, come take these and, you know, get them out into the universe. I don't know. It seems like little free libraries might be something that public libraries want to support, right? I mean, it seems like, I don't know. Think of it as extended service or, you know, community outreach of some kind. If any of you know of, I would love this feedback. If any of you know of a library that is overtly doing support and outreach and, you know, stuff with little free people running little free libraries, I'd love to know about it. I'd find that super fascinating. Okay, we got one more sponsor before we talk about new books, which is tall order this week. Tell me about this thing called Scribd.
Scribd is a subscription book service that gives you access to more than a million books and audiobooks. So you've got a phone, right? And you can download apps onto it, and it goes everywhere with you, like the subway or the waiting room at the doctor's office or the place that changes your tires and always takes longer than they say they're going to take. And we all know that it's a bad idea to leave the house without something to read. Or for me, it's a bad idea to like go to my couch without something to read. So you download Scribd, you go to scribd.com/bookriot, you get your subscription, you'll get a free month when you go to scribd.com/bookriot, and then you read to your little heart's content from their enormous catalog of ebooks and audiobooks. Scribd has some of the biggest publishers around. They've got major houses, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. They've also got small presses like McSweeney's, Counterpoint, Tin House. They have a ton of books. Like whatever you're into, they've got something for it. It gives you unlimited reading, and you choose from more than 40,000 audiobooks as well, including some of the biggest new releases. Scribd helps you find your way to the books you're going to love. So you can search for genre, you can search for your favorite authors, you can look at curated lists by theme and topic. Those lists are made by Scribd editors who know all the things that are in the catalog, and they put them together and say, so you're into this idea, here are a bunch of books about that thing. And the Scribd algorithm pays attention to what you rate and which books you like and also which books you don't like, so that they can recommend you other things that you will read. And hopefully your reading on Scribd gets better and better. So scribd.com/bookriot gets you 1 month for free. After that, it's $8.99 a month, unlimited ebook reading plus one audiobook. They also have audiobook credits that you can buy. This is a change in their model. We talked about it last week in a little bit more detail, but they have audiobook credits you can buy. So if you want to listen to more than one audiobook per month, you can do that as well. Some great comics also available in Scribd. Lumberjanes, which is my current favorite, is there. Hexed, which is a great comic that has to do with art, is there as well. Tons and tons and tons. I just think Scribd is awesome for exploring and expanding your readerly horizons, because there's no risk in trying something new. And we talk about this like every time we talk about Scribd, because I just think it's the greatest thing. You can be at the doctor's office, stuck in the waiting room, noodling around like, you know, I think maybe I want to read some essays, but I've never read this author before, or I've never read essays about this thing before. Let me noodle and see what's in Scribd. Open a book, give it a shot. If you love it, you keep going. If you don't, you just pick something else and you're out nothing.
It's kind of
other
that pleasure
than
of browsing a bookstore in your pocket, you know, like that feeling of like, I'm not sure, I'm going to browse and flick and turn and twist and double tap rather than wander and mosey.
Man, we know readers love to make lists of things to read, and Scribd will satisfy that desire for you. I have lost hours, I am not exaggerating, to scrolling through and just adding things to my list. And then there's pleasure in looking at the finished list of like, oh, these are all the things that I could read if I wanted to. It's enjoyable to see what's there. If you want to give this a shot, maybe you're not an ebook reader yet and you want to see what that business is all about, or you're not reading on your phone and you want to see what that's all about, this is a good way to do it too. I read a lot on my phone. I know you read on your phone when you're on the go. Mm-hmm. So Scribd, Scribd.com/bookriot. Get yourself a free month. If you love it, $8.99 a month after that for all the ebooks you can read, plus one audiobook a month. There are so many things to choose from, and we'll help you get started at Scribd.com/bookriot. You'll also see 15 of our favorite titles that are available in their catalog.
All right.
Okay.
Now, we can't do all the new books because we don't have 16 hours. But
yeah. But you know where else we talk about.
So highlight the ones you
want to
talk about. Then we'll do the ones where, you know, everyone knows that are out. We can talk about that.
Yeah. So I was overwhelmed by the number of new books that were out this week. So I really just chose the two that I think are the most interesting to talk about. If you want to hear about all kinds of new books, you can tune into the All the Books podcast.
Good tease. Which, yeah, excellent tease.
Thank you. I'm just going to, you know, brush my shoulders off and do some shameless self-promotion. Uh-huh. I host it with Liberty Hardy, who is incredible and reads more books than anyone I have ever met. And that is not an exaggeration. It's a half hour show every week. It comes out on Tuesdays about the week's best, most interesting book releases. We each pick three or four. I read widely. Liberty reads even more widely. And we go in depth about 8 books every week. So definitely more than I can give you in this segment. So my two for the week this week, the first one is one of my favorite books of the year. This is like in my top 5. And it was a huge surprise to me that I came out this way with this book. I loved it so much. It's called Sorcerer to the Crown by Zen Cho. This is a fantasy novel set in an alternate Victorian England where the main character, his name is Zacharias Wythe. He is the sorcerer royal to the Society of Unnatural Philosophers, which is the rich guys in Victorian England who either can perform magic or are rich enough that it doesn't matter that they can't. They get to be members of the club anyway. Mm. Magic in Zen Cho's world comes from fairyland, and it gets distributed from fairyland out to the rest of the world. And for some reason, there is no more magic in England. They've been cut off. So Zacharias has to go to fairyland to find out what's up and why the fairies have cut off the supply of magic to England. Complicating his life is the fact that he's a black man in Victorian England. He's a freed slave. The other members of the community don't trust him and don't want him to be the sorcerer royal. But that's one of those positions where, like, it's like the sword in the stone where the sword picks you. He was the one that I think it's the staff in the book chose. And so, like, it's undisputable that he is the sorcerer royal, but his peers don't like it. His position is contested. He's got to go to fairyland. Along the way, he stops at this school for girls to give a talk as a favor to a friend. And he sees that the girls at this school are being taught to suppress magic. They all have magical skills. They've been sent there by their parents, who don't know what to do with these young girls that can perform magic. And they're being taught, like, hexes, basically, that are harmful to them. They're going to hurt themselves. And he's like, we can't have this. Girls should be able to do magic. They shouldn't be harming themselves, suppressing their magic. And also, hi, England is low on magic. We need all the magic we can get. So it's better for girls to be able to do magic. It's good for girls to do it. It's good for the world if girls do magic. So he decides he's also, after he figures out this fairyland business, he's going to reform magical education. He meets a woman at the school named Prunella, who's lived there she went to school there, and she's, you know, been living there sort of as a teacher and servant ever since. And Prunella has really incredible powers. So she teams up with Zacharias. They become a pair. She's not like a secondary sidekick. She becomes his equal. And they set out on this crusade to bring England's magic back and also to change magical education. This book is so great. It's so fun. It's fast paced. It's really funny. The cast is diverse. The female characters are fully drawn. This book is feminist as all get out. And I just loved it. Like, Zen Cho is clearly saying something about the history of how women have been presented in fantasy stories and how it's totally silly that only the boys ever really do magic. Her characters have real points of view about it. This book was so much fun to read. And then I found out when I was finished that it's the first in a trilogy. And I'm not even mad that now I have to wait for the next ones. Like, you and I were talking about O'Neill's dictum, right, where you don't start a series until the series is finished. I usually am that way too. I don't even care. I will wait however long I have to wait for the next one. I hope it's not very long though, because it was so, so good. I bailed out on Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell about halfway through, which is still like, I read like 500 pages of that thing earlier this summer. I just couldn't do it. Sorcerer to the Crown is exactly what I wanted that kind of book to be. And I think if you loved Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell and that like high hat Victorian sensibility, but you want something that's a little more self-aware and has a sense of play to it, Sorcerer to the Crown by Zen Cho is going to do that for you as well. I just loved the crap out of this book. It's so, so good. The other big book this week that I want to talk about is one that you mentioned earlier, The Girl in the Spider's Web. It's the continuation of Stieg Larsson's Millennium series, starring Lisbeth Salander. This was written by David Lagercrantz based on, I think, notes and maybe partial manuscripts.
That's my understanding, too.
That Larsson had left behind, and it picks up the adventures of Blomqvist and Lisbeth Salander. That's all I know so far. I'm going to read it.
I'm going to read it too. The reviews I haven't read too many synopses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you like the original books, you're gonna enjoy this. On the whole, of course, you know, all reviews are some other ones, but right. From my reading of the reviews, I've got a good feeling that we're gonna like this. So the other big books that we didn't talk about, just so you know, the Franzen is out this week. Purity is out. Elena Ferrante, the end of her Neapolitan novel, Quartet, and the name is escaping me. I didn't put it down right in front of me, but the first one is My Brilliant Friend, and the fourth one is out. People we know love this book. A lot of book riot people, a lot of people we know.
We're both going to read them.
We're both going to read because O'Neill's dictum is fulfilled now that it's over. But I've heard they're great. It's translated from the Italian. But those are the big four, really, this week that are out. That's our show.
We got a little bonus show.
Yeah, you did.
Week.
Got a lot of little extra show. Used offer code RIOT. You got a little extra. See, that's what happens.
Well, hey there.
You can find us on Twitter at the Jeff O'Neill. That's me, O-N-E-A-L. Rebecca Shinsky at Rebecca Shinsky, S-C-H-I-N-S-K-Y. You can give us feedback, podcast@bookriot.com is our email address. You can find show notes for this and other episodes of the Book Riot podcast at bookriot.com/podcast. Also, if you go to bookriot.com and you on the top navigation, there's a little drop down for podcast. You can find all of our podcasts there. We have all the books. We mentioned Rebecca, Reading Lives, as we mentioned with me. We also have Dear Book Nerd with Rita Mead, who it's a podcast about life, love, and literature. As she has every couple weeks, she has a show with a new guest taking on a different bookish advice topic. And coming
Amanda's show starts next week.
Amanda Get Nelson's booked. Get Booked podcast starts. The first episode drops on September 10th. I believe, but you can find all of them there. So if you like one of these shows, chances are you're going to like some others. So do check those out there.
You can come to Book Riot Live on November 7th and 8th and hang out with us for 2 days of book nerd partying galore. All the information for that is at bookriotlive.com, and you can save $20 on your registration with the code Wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
I think that's it.
We'll talk to you later.
Have a good
okay,
week.
Okay, bye.